Okay, Matthew chapter 5 and verse 20. Matthew records a sermon by Jesus of Nazareth. And as he is talking about being a kingdom citizen and the righteousness that that requires, by righteousness he means a code of conduct, the way you live, he draws a comparison in verse 20 and he said, "I say to you that unless your righteousness surpasses that of the scribes and Pharisees, you will not enter the kingdom of heaven." There can be no confusion as to what he's referring to as you keep reading what he said. In verse 21, "You have heard that the ancients were told, 'You shall not commit murder.'" His audience would have been taught that the ancient prophets were told that by the men that he mentioned in verse 20, the scribes and the Pharisees. They taught the people, don't commit murder. But in verse 22, Jesus says, "But I say to you, everyone who is angry with his brother shall be guilty before the court." Now the Pharisees might have taught the Jews of their day it's wrong to commit murder, but they might not have said much about whether or not it was okay to wish a man dead because you were so angry with him. As you go throughout the rest of the sermon, you see that there is a difference between the inner man and the outer man by the example shown to the people from the scribes and the Pharisees in verse 20. In Matthew 23, as Jesus talks about the impending destruction of Jerusalem and why that's going to happen, he over and over denounces these men as hypocrites, which is what we typically think of when we think of a hypocrite. There's a difference between the inner man and the outer man. They don't look the same. In contrast to this, you look in Philippians chapter 3. Philippians chapter 3 and verse 5. Here is the first-hand account of one of these Pharisees. It is a common problem in every religion that you have those that don't always walk the walk. Evidently, that was a problem in abundance among Jews in the first century. But it was not true of all of them. And even if a religion is a false religion today, you will still find people that are true believers. Paul says this about himself in Philippians 3 and verse 5. There's a phrase in there, a Hebrew of Hebrews. He was the super Jew. Nobody was more Jewish than Paul. He wasn't just Jewish outwardly, not just a man that was circumcised, not just a man that would go to the priest and make the sacrifices. He was Jewish to the core. He was the truest of believers. Any way for us to test and verify that, you better believe it. We're going to start in the book of Acts and look at what the historian Luke wrote about this man, beginning in Acts chapter 8 and verse 3. This is not an exercise in simply going over what we know. This is about nailing down with certainty one of the five key facts to prove that there is historical evidence for the resurrection of Jesus from the dead. A 20th century Jewish statesman, Abba Eden, is reported to have said, and he may not have actually said this, but it's been said that he said it, that the two greatest tragedies to happen to Judaism in the first century was the destruction of the temple when Jerusalem fell in 70 AD, and the conversion of Saul of Tarsus. And you'll see why that is here in Acts chapter 8 and in the other references that we have. There can be no doubt that Saul of Tarsus was the most devout and zealous of Jews of his time. And there can also be no doubt that he became perhaps the most zealous Christian that ever lived. In Acts chapter 8 and verse 3, after you read of the martyrdom of Stephen, the first Christian to give up his life because of his testimony that Jesus is Lord, you read that Saul is present there at the end of Acts 7. In Acts 8 and verse 1, the first statement of the verse, he's in hearty agreement with putting him to death. On that day, a great persecution began against the church in Jerusalem, and they, the church, were all scattered because of this persecution. In verse 3, Saul began ravaging the church. Then Luke explains what he means. Just how far does he take this? He enters house after house. He drags off not just men, Even today, you know, it makes us a little squeamish when we think about maybe a smart bomb detonating on a school bus full of children in some country overseas. Makes us a little squeamish to think about women being caught as collateral damage. Paul, you sure you want to be known as the guy that is indiscriminate? Yeah, I'll take it. He drags off men and women and puts them in prison. Luke goes on to record in the next chapter, Acts 9 and verse 1, that it was not simply about depriving people of their property or of their liberty. This man wanted to do to every Christian what he witnessed his fellow Jews do to Stephen. At Acts 9 and verse 1, now Saul, still breathing threats and murder against the disciples of the Lord, went to the high priest. Now pay attention to that in verse 1. The high priest does not have to summon Paul. The high priest does not say, we need a volunteer. Paul says, I'm here and I'm ready to go. In verse 2, he asked for letters from him to the synagogues at Damascus, so that if he found any belonging to the way, both men and women, so evidently what he'd already started to do in Jerusalem, even taking the women away, it wasn't giving him any sleepless nights, he might bring them bound to Jerusalem. Now this is the setup, of course, for the first of three times that Luke records Paul's conversion, when Paul says that he sees the risen Jesus. It's interesting to me that when he's on the road to Damascus, he's walking that road because he wants to. He is the most dedicated Jew that you read of. Nobody has to tell him to go. With him, it's what you read of in Isaiah, here am I, send me. Look further down with me in verse 21. After his baptism, he stays within the city of Damascus. If you look about the middle of verse 19, after he takes food, for several days he was with the disciples who were in Damascus. Immediately he began to proclaim Jesus in the synagogue, saying, he is the Son of God. Now, first of all, what you saw just back in chapter 9, in verse 1, this is not just some nobody. This is not a Jew out to make a name for himself. He's evidently already in good standing with the ruling Jews. He goes to the high priest, and he's well received. His request is granted. There is no waiting. There is no arguing back and forth. There is no apparent lack of confidence in Paul's devotion to the cause. Now he goes into synagogues, a well-known man, to the high priest with letters verifying his authority and his delegated right to carry out this mission. He goes in verse 20, and now he's saying he is the Son of God. All those, verse 21, hearing him, continue to be amazed, and were saying, is this not he who in Jerusalem destroyed those who called on this name, and who had come here for the purpose of bringing them bound before the chief priests? That last phrase again testifies to his zeal for the cause. Here's a man who drops the hammer in Jerusalem and everybody scatters, but he's not going to let that put him off. He's going to go out and catch them. A fisher of men in a different sense at this point. When you look there in Acts 9, in verse 21, this is interesting too. At this point in our study, have we seen any reason at all to doubt Luke as a historian?
No.
Quite the opposite, right? And when you look at verses 21 and 22, does anything within this text contain a supernatural event of any sort? Not at all. So is there any rational reason on the surface to doubt what he says here? I can't see any, no matter where you are, whether you're a skeptic or believer. And what you have in verse 21 is Luke recording that even before Paul became a Christian, he's got quite a reputation. And this is good for us, because what we're observing is that it's not just Paul saying, as we'll see in a few minutes, I was a persecutor. It's not just Luke saying, as a historian, I was a persecutor. It's Luke saying, everybody said this. Everybody knew it. This was not done in some corner. Paul said that as he made the case for Jesus. You could take that exact same statement and apply it to his own deeds. Mark? Yes. Yeah. Yeah, Paul was not highly regarded by his countrymen as documented in the first century. And his name, as Mark says, is not held in high regard to Jews to this day. And small wonder, nobody did more damage to the cause of Judaism in the first century after Jesus than Paul himself. And that's clear mainly because, or one large reason, because of his honest and sincere devotion to Judaism in the first place. Look at chapter 22. This is the second time that his conversion is recorded in Acts. This is Paul's own words before Jews. They have already whipped up a violent mob. Back in verse 31 of chapter 21, it's clear that they want to kill him. So now in chapter 22, Paul is going to make his defense before them. If you look at chapter 22 and verse 3, I am a Jew, born in Tarsus of Cilicia, but brought up in the city, educated under Gamaliel, who was a man that was a Mosaical scholar in their time. Luke actually records a brief statement from him in the fifth chapter of this book. And Paul sat at his feet. He went on to say he was educated strictly according to the law of our fathers, being zealous for God, just as you all are today. I persecuted this way to the death, binding and putting both men and women into prisons. It's interesting that nobody denies that statement from him in this encounter. And if there is anybody that denies it from the first century, that record has not survived. But you would think, as much opposition as there was to Christianity, that such records would have been diligently preserved. In verse 5, he said, as also the high priest and all the council of the elders can testify, the ruling council of Jews, a.k.a. the Sanhedrin. What you have in verse 5 is similar to what we observed on Sunday, with Peter saying on Pentecost, Jesus performed miracles in your midst, just as you yourselves know. If Peter said that, he was an idiot, if it wasn't true. Well, here's Paul saying, I'm known by the chiefest Jews, and I have been given their seal of approval, in verse 5. If that was not true, he was a fool for saying it. If Luke is putting words into his mouth that he did not say, he's a fool for saying it. These men are living in the time that their enemies are still alive. If these are false statements, they can be easily exposed. And this is key for us, because we need to know that this man was who he claimed to be. Well known, supported, endorsed by the rulers of the Jews, the very people that put Jesus on the cross. From them I also received letters to the brethren, started off for Damascus in order to bring even those who were there to Jerusalem as prisoners to be punished. In if you drop down to verse 19, one more statement from his mouth. They themselves understand that in one synagogue after another, I used to imprison and beat those who believed in you. So here is a man that again and again used force. And he's going to make an interesting statement as to the why, what he was really looking for by beating these people and giving them such a terrible ordeal. If you look at chapter 26... the final time that his conversion is recorded, this time a defense made before Romans, In verse 9, "So then I thought to myself, I had to do many things hostile to the name of Jesus of Nazareth. And this is just what I did in Jerusalem. Not only did I lock up many of the saints in prisons, having received authority from the chief priests, but also when they were being put to death, I cast my vote against them." That last phrase is interesting because it could indicate that Paul himself was a member of the Sanhedrin. It would mean that he was there casting a ballot along with the rest of them, consenting to these people's deaths. So if he was, that would easily explain why he's so in with the high priest and the ruling council. In verse 11, he said, "As I punished them often in all the synagogues, I tried to force them to blaspheme." Now that's an interesting statement. Look in John chapter 10. In John chapter 10, you have a confrontation between the light and the dark that John writes about in his prologue. Jesus and the ruling Jews facing off against each other once more. In verse 31, they picked up stones again to stone him. So as Paul himself experienced time after time, the Jews had murder in their heart toward Jesus of Nazareth. In verse 32, he said, "I showed you many good works from the Father. For which of them are you stoning me? Is it for giving sight to a man born blind? Is it because I fed the 5,000? Which is it?" They said in verse 33, "For a good work we do not stone you, but for blasphemy." The next statement explains what they mean. What's the charge? "Because you, being a man, make yourself out to be God." You're guilty because you claim to be something that you're not. So here's Paul looking back on his former manner of life when he was a Jew. And he says, "I used to beat these people. I threw them in jail because I wanted them to blaspheme." We talked about this in our previous class. Why did the authorities try to persecute Paul and Peter and the rest? Answer, they wanted them to take back what they said. "We want you to say you didn't see Jesus risen from the dead." Here's a man that would grab people up, some of whom could not have made that claim. Many of these people could not have said, "I didn't see him risen from the dead." But what he wants them to say is, "Okay, I get it. Jesus is not the Son of God." But now as he's looking back on it from the standpoint of a Christian, having changed his mind, he would now regard that statement to be blasphemy. Whereas when he was a Jew, that would have been exactly what he wanted to hear these people say time and time again. In 1 Corinthians 15, this time from his own hand, verse 9, "I am the least of the apostles, not fit to be called an apostle, because I persecuted the church of God." That would seem to speak to the sincerity of heart and his guilt-ridden conscience over his former actions. You may have experienced something like this. Maybe you've prayed to God for forgiveness after you've repented of something. And maybe in your prayer you've expressed something similar to what the prodigal son told his father. "I'm not worthy to be called your son. I don't deserve the grace that I'm asking you for right now. I don't deserve to be called your child or a disciple, but I want you to forgive me of what I've done." And so here he is expressing his own humility. He's been elevated to this position of leadership in the church, and he says, I'm not fit for it because of what I once did. I persecuted the church of God, and the lengths to which he was willing to go in this persecution are recorded in Galatians chapter 1. Interesting statement here. Galatians 1 and verse 13. "You have heard of my former manner of life in Judaism." A statement, by the way, which they don't object to. They don't challenge this. Everybody knows it. It's common knowledge. "How I used to persecute the church of God beyond measure." Now, maybe the last phrase in that verse, I don't know for certain, but maybe it explains what he means by beyond measure. "I tried to destroy it." I was in Galveston the last couple days, and every now and then you can see a picture of a building or a section of the city that was destroyed when Hurricane Ike went through. And you can still see the remnants of some of the buildings that were there, and you can kind of get an idea of what was lost. But what if everything on the island was wiped out? What if there was nothing left? after a hurricane blew through? What if there were no docks, there were no piers, there was nothing? Would you even be able to get a sense? Could you calculate what had been lost? Maybe that's what Paul's saying here. I wanted it gone beyond measure. I didn't even want people to realize how much damage had been done because I wanted it stamped out from the face of the earth altogether. Every copy of these letters, I wanted them burned. Everybody that named the name of Jesus, husband and wife, I wanted them dead. Let nobody say that they believe that Jesus rose from the dead. And so he makes this statement again and again, Philippians and 1 Timothy. Now go back, or stay in Galatians 1. Drop down further in the text on page 36, the second thing that we point out. From his time as a persecutor, he mentions what he did after his conversion. He said that in verse 18, 3 years later, I went to Jerusalem. Verse 21, then I went into the regions of Syria, which is where Damascus is, and Cilicia. I was still unknown by sight to the churches of Judea, which were in Christ, but only they kept hearing, he who once persecuted us is now preaching the faith which he once tried to destroy. So again, it's not just Luke, it's not just Paul. Everybody is saying this. And Luke is recording it. He records it back in Acts 9. We pointed out in one text already in this chapter that that was the case. Go back to Acts 9. You may remember what happens in verse 26. Once he goes to Jerusalem, he was trying to associate with the disciples. But, did they let him? They're scared to death of him. Quite literally. And why wouldn't they be? They were all afraid of him, not believing that he was a disciple. You don't have me fooled. I know better. Of course, Barnabas vouches for his sincere change of heart. And it's not long after this that you begin to read of his own persecutions that he suffers. This is good for us. Right now, we're not treating these books as inspired. We're just treating them as historical records. And what we see is within 3 years of his conversion, everybody knew what this guy was like when he was a Jew. He was hardcore, evidently had no problems with Judaism as a religion. And everybody knew just how far he was willing to go to defend the faith against these heretics that were saying that some carpenter was back from the dead. Now let's talk about the shift. The bottom of page 36. Saul the persecutor, that's how we meet him. But then he becomes Paul the preacher. Well, how come? Ennis, I don't know what else to do but just let the man explain it himself, right? 1 Corinthians 15. In 1 Corinthians 15, you have a catalog of appearances by Jesus. This is not every appearance, of course. Verse 5, he appeared to Cephas, then to the 12. Verse 6, he appeared to more than 500 at one time. Verse 7, James, his brother, then to all the apostles. And verse 8, last of all, as to one untimely born, he appeared to me also. Now, even if a person says, well, I don't believe that. I don't think Jesus came back from the dead because nobody can do that. That's fine. But at the very least, what do you have to admit? He believed it. You may not believe it, but you have to admit he believed it. Look over in Matthew 27. I want you to see something else. That's right. That's something else we'll talk about here in a minute. Look back over in Matthew 27. When we started out, we drew a distinction between Paul and the reputation of the Pharisees in general. Here's another thing about it. I don't know. This is one of those things I'd love to know about. I don't know. None of us know. Where was Paul when the crucifixion happened? Wouldn't you like to know that? Wouldn't you like to know If he was in the Sanhedrin and he was there at the trial that night, what was he saying? Would he have been one of those saying, this shouldn't be done this way, even if he didn't believe in Jesus? In Matthew 27, though, you see that the rest of the Pharisees, like Paul, they have no problem resorting to killing somebody if they feel that it's necessary. There's a huge difference in the motive. In verse 18, you have Pilate, who's a politician and a ruler. He ought to know something about what makes a ruler tick, like the rest of the Jews that are in front of him. He knew that because of envy, they had handed him over. They are fine using the cross out of mercenary motives. If they feel envious toward Jesus, they obviously feel threatened by him. And if they're going to kill him, they feel like they've got something to gain. But as you go through Acts, as you go through Paul's writings, it's obvious there's nothing in his mind as for mercenary motive. He's got nothing to gain personally by killing these people. He's a true believer. He's the truest of believers that you can find in the first century. And as you go through the New Testament, as you go through the book of Acts, as you read the conversion stories in Acts 9, 22, 26, as you see the fallout from that over and over, guess what? You find the same thing. In fact, look at chapter 23 of Acts. Paul's own words before the Sanhedrin, the ruling council of the Jews, Acts 23 and verse 1. Looking intently at the council, he said, "Brethren, I have lived my life with a perfectly good conscience before God up to this day. Whether I'm a Jew or I'm a Christian, I've made every decision I've made out of a desire to try to please God." You wonder if he was tempted to say, "Can you say the same thing?" Obviously they can't. Herb?
No, Todd, I missed the big chapter verse where you...
Acts 23 and verse 1. Acts 23 and verse 1. Don't have it on the sheet, but if you want to make a note of that, you can have that there. So, when he is busy consenting to Stephen's death, when he's rounding people up, he's sleeping good at night, and then when he becomes a Christian and when he starts to be on the receiving end of these same persecutions, he's still sleeping good at night. And he says, "I made this change not out of mercenary motives, not out of anything to gain personally, but because I believe I saw the risen Jesus. I believe he appeared to me on the road to Damascus." And so if you look underneath Paul the preacher, number one there, this is so good for us. We have Matthew and John, two men who were there for 3 years with Jesus. They say, "I saw him come back from the dead." Now their testimony alone is interesting, because did either of those men ever expect to see Jesus after he went to the cross?
No.
Not at all. But more than that, now we have a man who would have gladly sent Matthew and John to a cross. And he says, "I saw the risen Jesus." Now, if Matthew and John never expected to see the risen Jesus, what do you think about Paul? Would he have expected to see the risen Jesus? Is he the kind of guy that would have been primed for a hallucination? I myself am skeptical. Look at 2 Corinthians 11. Once again, we have the question of his sincerity. And we're not going to look at all of these references. Just some of the things that he himself writes about. And we'll look at one of them in Acts here in a second. 2 Corinthians 11 and verse 23. In defense of his own ministry, he talks about the things that he endured. Imprisonments. Beaten times without number. You read about that in Acts 16 with the Philippian jailer when they lock him up. They throw him in there. They beat him. Often in danger of death. 5 times I received from the Jews 39 lashes. I wouldn't even want to be flogged one time for 39 times. I wouldn't even want to be flogged just one lash one time. 5 times, 39 lashes. 3 times I was beaten with rods. Once I was stoned. That's an interesting moment that he refers to. That's the one I want to look at. Three times I was shipwrecked. When he wrote this letter, that fourth shipwreck you read about at the end of Acts hadn't happened yet. Once will be bad enough. Three times you read that and you think, surely no more. One more after that. A night in the deep, a night and a day I've spent in the deep. Frequent journeys, dangers from rivers, robbers, from my countrymen, from the Gentiles, the city, the wilderness, the sea, false brethren. Surely he must have been making a lot of money to put up with all that. Hardly. Maybe if he had stayed as a Jew, he might have been wealthy. But he gave it all up. Look in Acts 14. When you're in a position of power, you get so many perks and privileges. You got people looking after you all the time. But he gave all that up too. Acts 14 and verse 19. When he writes about it to the Corinthians, he just says he was stoned. But Jews came from Antioch and Iconium, having won over the crowds. They stoned Paul and dragged him out of the city. You think, well, what did they just leave him there for? They thought they got him. Supposing him to be dead. They thought they'd finished the job. It might almost sound like when you read it in Corinthians that he had to throw his hands up, protect himself. It was uncomfortable and it hurt, but they got through it okay. Must have been a pretty severe stoning for them to think that they'd finally gotten rid of this troublemaker. Was he sincere? He had to be. At the bottom of page 36... his sufferings were also recorded by Clement of Rome, Polycarp, Tertullian, Dionysius of Corinth, Origen. Tertullian, before 200 AD, he wrote about the reign of Nero in the first century, that Paul is beheaded has been written in their own blood. And if a heretic wishes his confidence to rest upon a public record, the archives of the empire will speak. So let's say there's some pagan during this time, and they say, I just don't believe in all this stuff. These guys say that they saw Jesus and they were willing to put their lives on the line. How do you know that happened? Tertullian says, just go to the imperial records. They'll tell you about it. If you don't believe me, if you don't think these men were willing to risk all and did risk all, let the pagans tell you themselves. The archives of the empire will speak, as would the stones of Jerusalem. We read the lives of the Caesars. At Rome, Nero was the first who stained with blood the rising faith. Then is Peter girt by another when he is made fast to the cross. Then does Paul obtain a birth suited to Roman citizenship, when in Rome he springs to life again, ennobled by martyrdom. Very flowery way of saying that he died. And upon his death, receives the promise of eternal life, as Tertullian looks at it. So here we have a man who said, I believe in Moses with all my heart. And then later he said, I believe in Jesus too. And I'm willing to put everything on the line. I'm willing to give all, and he did give all for the sake of that testimony. Now, go back to Galatians 1. Just a few minutes left. Keith?
Something that strikes me about Paul, when you look at other, what people consider religious leaders in other denominations and whatnot, what to me also strikes me about Paul is the fact that his focus never changed. His outlook on what he was doing did, but his focus never changed. When he was a Pharisee, when he was a Hebrew of Hebrews, he was trying to serve God the way he thought he was supposed to. So his focus never changed. I'm zealous for God. I'm going to do what I think is right. He didn't understand that Jesus was a suffering Messiah. He was the one who came to die for all man's sin. He never lost that focus. He got righted. He got a better understanding of what was going on. Christ came, revealed himself, told him, why are you persecuting me? For me, that lends so much more credibility to him, because it's not, I'm a Joseph Smith and I was trying to, you know, rob people of money or do something like here, and then eventually I created a religion. Paul's focus always was, and he admittedly says that he was wrong, but he always was wanting to do what was right by God,
yeah.
Serve God, and so changing his shifting his thoughts and his lifestyle based
right.
on that helps me understand the sincerity that he has.
Right. And when he does convert, you mentioned Joseph Smith. Paul does not create Christianity. Muhammad creates Islam. Joseph Smith creates Mormonism. Paul doesn't do that. He converts to a religion that a man the Jews would have thought to be cursed because he died on a cross. Converts to that one out of his sincere desire to serve the Lord. If you look in Galatians 1 and verse 11, what's the big deal about this? First of all, Paul claimed his reason for converting was because he saw Jesus on the road, face to face. How many of us can say the same thing? How many of us can say that we first heard about Jesus because of what mom or dad or both said? How many of us can say we converted to Jesus because of what we might have heard from a preacher? Or because of what we read in the Bible? All of those are second, third, 1 billionth hand reasons why we would have first been exposed to the gospel. But Paul says, I didn't hear it from anybody else first. I got it straight from the horse's mouth. In Galatians 1 and verse 11, he said, I would have you know, brethren, the gospel which was preached by me is not according to man. And then he tells you what he means. For I neither received it from man, nor was I taught it, but I received it through a revelation of Jesus Christ. He makes a very similar statement to the Corinthians about the Lord's Supper. I received this from the Lord, is what he tells them. So, when we come to faith in the risen Jesus today, we initially hear about it from somebody else. But Paul says, I'm different. Which means he's in a very unique position on the basis of his claim when he chooses to convert to Christianity. Now, this raises a couple more questions. I mentioned Muhammad and Joseph Smith a moment ago. Why give Paul special consideration? Why not the man that started Islam? Why not the man that started Mormonism? Paul says, I saw Jesus on the road. Muhammad said, I got visited by Gabriel. And Joseph Smith said that he was paid visits from, what's his name?
Moroni.
Thank you. So why not them? No backup? But we're not just simply listening to testimony, we're weighing the evidence. Are there any problems with the Book of Mormon that we've talked about before? How much archaeological support is there for what it says? None. What about the Quran? Does it get anything recorded in history wrong? Crucifixion. Right? That's a pretty big one. So we're not just listening to testimony, we're weighing the evidence. I want you to also consider something here with me that two men that wrote this book I've been appealing to a lot, they pointed out. It is thought by many that Muhammad's dissatisfaction with the paganism and idolatry in his society existed prior to his alleged revelations. If that's true, then what that means is it's still pretty different from Paul. Muhammad did not have to leave one thing and go to something else. He'd already left it. Is there any indication whatsoever that Paul was feeling any dissatisfaction at all with Judaism when he makes the switch? He's content as a cucumber. I'm happy with this. And then he makes the transition. Whether that's true of Muhammad or not, in a way, is irrelevant. Although it's an interesting comparison. What we do know is that Paul was the most dedicated Jew of his time, a Hebrew of Hebrews, and his sudden total religious makeover in the face of certain suffering must still be reckoned with. So, page 38. We have five stubborn facts. The first of which is what? Jesus died by crucifixion. What's the second one? They believe, the disciples believe, that they saw him risen from the dead. Now here's our third one. The persecutor becomes the preacher. That's a way of just capturing the full transition and the zeal of his life. Essentially, we're saying the same thing. Like the disciples, he believed he saw the risen Jesus. Now somebody may choose to argue whether or not he actually did. What you cannot deny is that he genuinely believed it. And the fact that he makes such a profound change in his life, that's evidence that he truly believed what he said he saw. So these are the first three. We got two more. And Lord willing, we're going to talk about them on Sunday. Those lessons are out and available in the back. Herb?
question, even though Jesus revealed to him, but could you say that he still went back and searched to make sure that those things which were spoke of that God spoke to him, he said that he did go back and still search your capital?
That he still did what?
You know, when God revealed to him. And so for him to believe that God, that Jesus is the risen God, my question to you, did you would think that he would go back and still search it carefully and make sure that those things were so that was mentioned?
Well, look, Paul's the kind of guy that gladly accepts the Bereans testing everything that he said from the Old Testament in Acts 17:11. He's a man that was already familiar with the law. If we know anything about Paul, he's not the kind of guy to just believe something blindly. So certainly, if he's confronted with what he sees on the road to Damascus and he hears things from Jesus, definitely he's going to be going through his head, checking, does this line up with what Hosea said, with what Isaiah said? Yeah, sure. Mark? Okay. So the European Jews?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. We're out of time. Thank you for your attention tonight.